Last Friday, President Donald Trump signed an executive order that barred all refugees from entering the United States for 120 days and suspended all immigration for 90 days from seven predominantly Muslim countries. The signing immediately sparked controversy. Protests began at several airports around the United States. Several federal judges issued emergency stays temporarily blocking parts of Trump's order. Confusion arose about how consistently the Customs and Border Protection officers were complying with the court's rulings. Although the Trump administration did walk back some aspects of the executive order over the weekend, it stuck by its main provisions. Here is White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer defending the administration's actions.
Look, coming into this country is still a privilege. We're the greatest country on earth. And being able to come to America is a privilege, not a right. And it is our duty, and it is the president's goal, to make sure that everybody who comes into this country, to the best of our ability, is here because they want to enjoy this country and come in peacefully. And so he takes that obligation extremely seriously.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the foreign policy challenges facing President Donald Trump. On this show, we examine what he has done, what he has said he will do, and what decisions he might make. This week, we're going to talk about immigration. With us to explore President Trump's executive order is Edward Alden, Ted, a senior fellow here at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ted has written widely and well on immigration issues, including the 2008 book, The Closing of the American Border, Terrorism, Immigration, and Security Since 9/11. Ted, thanks for being here.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, Jim. Thank you.
Let's get right into it, Ted, by sort of setting the picture for people. What precisely did the executive order say?
Well, there were a whole series of things in the order. It's a fairly complicated order, but the highlights would be, as you mentioned, 120-day suspension of all refugee processing. So no new refugees approved for admittance to the United States for 4 months. An indefinite suspension of admission of refugees from Syria, which is obviously in the middle of a massive refugee crisis as a result of the civil war there. The administration has also suspended all travel. So this is not just refugees. This is students, business travelers, tourists, anyone else from seven specific countries for 90 days. These are countries thought by the administration to pose a particular threat of terrorism. So they include Iran, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, Libya, and Sudan. So that's a three-month suspension. There's been a debate over whether that also includes green card holders from those countries living in the United States. We can talk about that a little more. Little less notice, the administration is going to cut the total number of refugees admitted for the rest of this fiscal year from the 110,000 that had been planned under the Obama administration to 50,000, which would be the lowest cap for refugee admissions to the United States since the early 1980s.
And just to put it in perspective, in 2016, 85,000 refugees and asylum seekers were admitted into the United States.
Yeah, and the Obama administration had been planning for 110,000 in FY 2017, which runs through the end of September 2017. So that's a big reduction. And then there are provisions in the order that give special preference to Christian refugees, primarily from the Middle East, those believed to be fleeing religious persecution. So there's some other smaller things in the order, but that gives us a lot to talk about. Those were certainly the most controversial elements of what the president signed on Friday.
Several federal court judges put in stays for parts of the executive order. Can you sort of walk us through what it is that the federal court judges said? Because to the best of my knowledge, none of them ruled on the overall constitutionality of what the president was proposing. They had to do with sort of aspects of the executive order.
No, that is correct. So, I mean, what we saw over the weekend was people from, you know, who were citizens of these seven countries. And let's be clear, that can include dual citizens, not Americans. But if you're a, a Canadian Syrian or so if you're, you know, if, a French of Iranian origin.
So right, if you're a British citizen who also, let's say, was born in Iraq,
yes.
you would be affected by
yes,
this.
Yes, exactly.
Whereas normally because you had British passport, you could come into the country no problem.
Relatively easily. So a lot of people caught up. So what happened over the weekend is you had people who had boarded planes for the United States. They had valid visas to enter the United States. President signs the order on Friday afternoon, and the Customs and Border Protection officers move immediately to enforce it by detaining these individuals as they arrived at airports in the United States, saying, as a result of the president's order, even though you have a lawful visa in your hand, we are not going to admit you to the United States. And that quickly touched off, you know, both lawyers coming to the airports to try to aid these people, to try to talk to CBP and make a legal case as to why they should be admitted to the country. And then widespread public protests with people showing up at the airports and you know chanting, let them in. And so that was kind of the immediate impact. And there are, you know, presumably hundreds of others who are stranded at airports overseas who otherwise had their papers in order to travel. I mean, people who've wrapped up their lives, sold apartments, all their belongings, you know, bought airplane tickets. So
talk about that for a second yeah. because the White House on Sunday announced that so-called green card holders would not be subject to this. And maybe you can explain what a green card holder is first. And the second thing is yesterday the White House announced that refugees who reach the United States by this Thursday, February 2nd, will be allowed. And if you just sort of explain this sort of walking back of the original order.
Yeah, I mean, from your questions, obviously, there's a lot of fluidity here. So the court actions that you talked about, the injunctions, basically said the administration has to let people who had their papers who were in transit enter the United States. And so the extension for people who were on their way up through Thursday is a response to those court orders. There seemed to be uncertainty from the outset whether green card holders, so these are people who are lawful permanent residents in the United States. They are basically entitled to almost everything that a U.S. citizen is entitled to except for the right to vote. And so there was quite a bit of shock when, you know, say, you know, an Iranian who held a green card in the United States who happened to have traveled abroad was suddenly told he or she can't come back to the United States. So it seems that the White House has walked that one down and said, no, it doesn't apply to green card holders. But you know, what the listener should get a sense of here is the complete chaos that followed the president's signing of these orders. Normally, these things are vetted very carefully, discussed with the agencies that are going to implement them, scrutinized for legal problems that may arise. It appears that little or none of this was done in advance of these orders. So everybody in the administration is kind of scrambling to make sense of what was done.
What I was struck by is that General John Kelly, I should say Secretary Kelly, head of the Department of Homeland Security, learned about the final order while he was on a plane, Coast Guard plane, flying back from Miami to Washington, D.C. In the middle, as he was getting the briefing, someone apparently was watching a TV set and saw that the president was actually signing the executive order. And that's significant because Secretary Kelly heads up the organization, includes, among other things, Customs and Border Patrol. It contains Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and also, I believe, TSA. Three of the organizations are going to be heavily involved in all of this, and they weren't up to speed. So maybe we'll tackle that question right now. What does this say about how the Trump administration intends to govern, if it says anything?
Well, I think we will see as it unfolds. I mean, very clearly, this was done by a very small circle of individuals within the White House with very little consultation with anyone else in the administration. So I think it tells us that the White House, even more than usual, is going to be the power center in this new administration. I think the second thing it tells us is that the president is really much more worried about the symbolism, about the kind of shock and awe of these actions. I mean, he wanted to send a message. Look, I said during the campaign that I was going to bar Muslims from entering the United States, and I'm doing it. I'm living up to my campaign promise. This is a security threat, and I'm going to be a tough president who's going to act on it. And there's a lot of evidence that his supporters are quite enthusiastic about what he's done. And I think it's pretty clear that for the folks in the White House, the symbolism of the action, even with the disruption it caused, was far more important than making sure it was unrolled in a careful, well thought out fashion, implemented in a reliable way. I think it was much more about the symbolism than it was about the particulars of the implementation.
I want to note in that score that also the Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, was not part of this. And the Department of Defense has an equity or interest here because they're very concerned about people who work for the U.S. military in a place like Iraq being able to come back in. And there were a number of stories about people who had worked for the U.S. military not being admitted into the country. Likewise, Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, hasn't been confirmed yet. And as best we can tell, the State Department wasn't involved in a process that affects them. Let's talk about this issue of what President Trump said on the campaign trail about a Muslim ban. First off, is the executive order that the president signed on Friday a Muslim ban?
No, not broadly speaking. So it is targeting a narrower subsection of countries. I mean, the refugee ban is sort of everybody. So that's for at least a short period, regardless of religion. The seven countries that are targeted for the general travel ban are all Muslim-majority countries. But there are, of course, many other Muslim-majority countries, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia,
Pakistan, India.
Of course, India has a very large Muslim population, as does Bangladesh. Those countries are not covered under the order. So it's certainly not a kind of wide Muslim ban of the sort that he seemed to float at times in the campaign. But there are, you know, there are elements of it that seem quite clearly to discriminate on a religious basis, particularly language that suggests special preference for Christian refugees. And I think as this is subject to a constitutional challenge, and we have several states led by the state of Washington that have actually filed such a challenge. So this is a broader challenge to the order as opposed to the narrow injunctions that we saw over the weekend. I think that will be at the heart of the case. Is this de facto a religious test for admission to the United States, which could well be found to be unconstitutional?
Yeah. Let's talk about that, Ted. You're not a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer. So we are not talking from areas of great expertise, but I'm just trying to sort of work through what aspect of the executive order would be unconstitutional. Is it that provision you referred to that says after we overhaul refugee policy, individuals from religious minorities will get a preference? And President Trump went on, I think it was Christian Broadcasting Network on Friday, to seem to indicate or talked about wanting to do more for Christian refugees. So is that the part that's unconstitutional or maybe subject to constitutional challenge? Or are there other parts of the executive order that are subject to arguments that the president is overreaching in terms of the exercise of his executive power?
There may well be. I can't claim that to know all of the grounds on which it might be challenged. I think the discrimination issue will go back to the 1965 Immigration Act, which is the law that was passed by Congress that is still largely the law of the land today when it comes to immigration policy, and really opened the United States up to the entire world for the first time. Up until that point, there had really been kind of very strong preference for Western European immigrants in the United States. And the 65
Act reversed a very long history of actually excluding people based on their nationality and country of origin.
And, you know, effectively religious tests as well. So 65 was a big change in U.S. immigration policy. The 65 Act is pretty clear that you're not supposed to discriminate on religious grounds in terms of immigrant admissions to the United States. So I am suspecting that will be the basis of the constitutional challenge. That said, the president has very broad authority to exclude anyone that he has reason to believe might pose any sort of threat to U.S. national security. And the courts have tended to be very deferential on that front. So I think it's going to be, you know, kind of a back and forth between, you know, are the discriminatory elements of this broad enough that they actually constitute a constitutional violation versus the president's broad authority on security grounds? I think that will be the nub of the case that gets fought out in the courts.
And I think lawyers will argue about this and will go to the courts, and these things tend to take time to work their way out. But looking at it, I think it's important to keep in mind that it is possible that a court could find an element of the executive order unconstitutional or in violation of statute or beyond the president's power doesn't necessarily invalidate the entire executive order, which, as you point out, the president historically has had considerable leeway in terms of making decisions about immigration. And the Trump administration, I assume their lawyers will go and point to instances in which the Obama administration, President Obama, exercised executive power, executive discretion in this area.
Yeah, I would agree. And also, I mean, remember that most of these actions are time limited, you know, 90 days, 120 days. Now, the executive order indicates that depending on the response of other countries, some of this might be extended, that there might be kind of broader visa bans from certain countries that are deemed to not be cooperating adequately with the United States. So it could be that much of this is extended beyond the 90 days. But you know, as you know, court cases often take a long time to drag out. I wanted to ask you a bit, though, about foreign reaction. I mean, what have we seen so far? And even if this does kind of get wrapped up in 4 months and we move back to something like the previous status quo, what do you think the potential foreign policy ramifications for the United States are going to be here?
Well, initially, it's played very, very badly. You have seen a number of foreign leaders come out and criticize the administration's decision. I think it was interesting to follow Prime Minister Theresa May of Great Britain, who was in Washington on Friday, shortly after she left. She was going to Ankara to meet with President Erdogan. President Trump signed the executive order. Initially, the reaction from Prime Minister May was to try not to take a position on it, but it became clear that this was very unpopular in Great Britain. There was an online petition, last count I think, had gotten 1.2 million signatures to deny having President Trump come to Great Britain on a state visit. And the phone call that German Chancellor Angela Merkel had with President Trump on Sunday, she reminded him that the United States was a signatory to the Geneva Conventions that govern refugees and has an obligation in this respect. I believe also French President Hollande gave a speech in which he talked about the need to live up to Western values, and I would take it as a perhaps not so oblique or subtle shot at the White House. So clearly this hasn't played well in places like Iraq. The Iraqi parliament, I believe, has passed legislation or is about to pass legislation that would require reciprocity. That is, if you're going to treat our citizens this way, we're going to treat American citizens this way. And that, Ted, actually takes us into the whole question of sort of the wisdom of the order, whether the president has the constitutional authority to do what he did. The fact is it necessarily wise to do this? Not everything that you can do is something that you should do. And a lot of the objections coming from national security officials has been on the grounds that this is a misguided order that will not do what the president says will do. Actually, quite the opposite. It will make Americans less safe rather than more secure. What is your assessment of sort of the arguments against the travel ban and refugee halt on the grounds of its merits or its wisdom or its efficacy?
Yeah, I think on numerous grounds, it's deeply unwise. I mean, if we go back to the post 9/11 period, the Bush administration implemented a number of policies that in some ways were broader than the Trump measures. There were more countries targeted. There were about 24 Muslim majority countries targeted by the Bush administration measures, though in some ways narrower. They were essentially what we would call today extreme vetting requirements as opposed to outright bans on travel. But that caused a lot of difficulty for the administration. I mean, I interviewed Secretary Powell late in the Bush administration. He said he spent hours on the phone with foreign leaders trying to talk them down. They were so upset over these measures. But they in the context, they were somewhat understandable. Post 9/11, the United States really knew almost nothing about who was coming to the country. And so you had to use these crude kinds of proxies. You know, we've been attacked 9/11 by Islamic terrorists. Therefore, we need to kind of target anybody who we think might broadly be sort of like the people who carried out the 9/11 attack. In the last 15 years, the United States has become far more sophisticated. We have real intelligence. We follow people's travel patterns. We've requirements for secure identity documents. We fingerprint almost everybody who's coming to the United States. We check those fingerprint records against Defense Department records of fingerprints that they've recovered from battlefields and safe houses. We have deep intelligence sharing with allies around the world in Western Europe and beyond. We do far more detailed interviews at the consulates. There are many, many ways in which the screening process is vastly better than it was pre-9/11. So the problem here is that the administration is reverting to these very crude tools at a time when the United States actually has far more sophisticated tools. It's not to say that there isn't room for improvement. There certainly is. But we as a country have spent the last 15 years trying to learn how to target genuine threats as opposed to saying, you know, all people of this sort we need to be worried about. So it's a huge step backwards, I think, in terms of security, and it's probably going to undermine the intelligence and law enforcement cooperation that has prevented another large-scale terrorist attack since 9/11.
Well, this gets us into the question, of course, in terms of its efficacy. There's sort of, I think, two basic arguments against the executive order in terms of its ability to make America more safe. One is that what you just alluded to, it doesn't actually tackle the real problem, and it's not likely to work. The other is that we've just handed a recruiting victory to ISIS and other radical extremists because we're feeding into their narrative of a civilizational war, that the United States is waging war not on Islamic jihadists, but against Islam writ large. Let's sort of begin with sort of the first argument, which you've sort of already mentioned in terms of the fact we already have in place intensive vetting of people. I mean, President Trump has argued over and over again that we haven't been vetting people sufficiently, and he wants extreme vetting. But what I'm hearing from you is that our vetting is fairly thorough, particularly on the refugee front. I mean, people who want to come into the United States as refugees, you're talking a 2-3-4 year period.
That is the longest and most rigorous vetting process in the United States. If you were a would-be terrorist wanting to get into the United States, you would not spend 4 years as a refugee camp waiting to be vetted. I think, you know, unfortunately, what we saw partly as a result of the terrorist attacks in Europe is a conflation of the American situation with the European situation. The Europeans, for a variety of reasons, I think much to their own chagrin now, never really acted post 9/11 to try to gain control over their borders. And when you had the refugee flood out of Syria and you know, Angela Merkel admitting hundreds of thousands, Sweden, France, and others, very admirable on a human level. But the reality was they didn't know a lot about those people. And we know that terrorists use that refugee flow as a way to enter Europe. But that's not the case for the United States, right? Our vetting process is far, far more thorough. We know who the people are, by and large, who are coming into the United States. The Europeans didn't.
So Donald Trump can be right in his criticisms of how the Europeans handled the refugee issue, but not necessarily be right about how the United States has handled the refugee issue.
Yeah, I would agree that the Europeans were dangerously lax, and I think it was a mistake.
Another criticism that's been leveled against this executive order in terms of its efficacy in stopping terrorists is that it's targeting the wrong countries and is targeting the wrong problem. Let me just sort of point on a couple of statistics. I'm looking here, and just two of the 182 radical Islamic terrorists who plotted attacks on the United States or on inbound planes between 1990 and 2015 entered the United States as refugees. None of the seven countries singled out in this executive order has produced anyone who's killed Americans on U.S. soil. Meanwhile, the four Muslim-majority countries left off the list that produced the 9/11 attackers: Egypt, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. And what I'm hearing from a lot of people who do counterterrorism operations that they're much more concerned about the problem of homegrown terrorism, that is, people who are here who are citizens carrying out attacks, and that this is sort of misplaced. How do you assess those arguments?
I would agree very much with the criticism. Broadly, I think nationality-based restrictions, as I say, are a very crude tool. I mean, there are a lot of countries that have developed terrorists, including the United States and Canada and Western Europe, the homegrown terrorism problem. So the notion that you can target a handful of countries and, you know, hassle or bar all of the ordinary innocent travelers from those countries, and somehow that's an effective counterterrorism strategy. We tried versions of that after 9/11. They failed miserably. You have to have targeted information, good intelligence. The homegrown terrorism aspect is very interesting. I think one of the reasons we've seen more of it in the United States is precisely because we are better at identifying and keeping out foreign fighters who might want to come to the United States to carry out attacks. The homegrown radicalism problem is a real one. If you look at, for instance, a report that the House Homeland Security Committee did about a year and a half ago, bipartisan support led by Chairman Mike McCaul, who a lot of people thought was going to end up as the DHS secretary, but did not, for a variety of reasons, Republican. You know, a whole series of recommendations in there about how better to target the emerging nature of the terrorist threat. ISIS is not al-Qaeda. It's been much better at using the internet and the web, at doing transnational recruiting. There is indeed a new set of problems that needs to be tackled. But to revert to these very crude tools, I think, is actually going to exacerbate the problem and undermine the intelligence law enforcement cooperation that the U.S. needs, both abroad and domestically here in our own Muslim communities, in order to identify and stop threatening individuals before they can act.
Well, let's talk about the other main challenge to this executive order on efficacy grounds, and that is handing ISIS a major recruiting tool. I've heard people sympathetic to the administration saying that there are plenty of people in the Islamic world who've already been radicalized, hate us. This is not going to make the problem worse. Number of other people, former national security officials, arguing the contrary, that this is actually going to make the problem worse. How do you assess those contending arguments? How should we think about them?
Well, it does seem to be a real divide between this administration and all the preceding ones. I mean, you look both in the George W. Bush administration and in the Barack Obama administration, there was a very deliberate, conscious effort to draw a distinction between Islamic radicalism, the jihadis, and the vast, vast majority of peaceful Muslims, many of them in countries that are close allies with the United States. You know, by targeting this so broadly, the administration has made it very difficult for traditional friends of the United States to continue cooperating with the United States. Because that is a significant problem, right? It's a significant problem more broadly for U.S. foreign policy, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. But it's also a significant problem in counterterrorism. I mean, we just as a country don't have eyes and ears everywhere in the world to allow us to identify threats before they can materialize. We need the help of our friends, and particularly moderate Muslims across the world and governments that are friendly to the United States. This sort of order makes it very hard for those people and those governments to maintain cooperation with the United States. And to the extent that we find ourselves on our own, we're going to be blinder and more vulnerable than we were before.
I mean, it seems to me that from the vantage point of American foreign policy, you can't let reactions in foreign capitals be the sole determinant of what it is that you do. And there are going to be cases in which you're going to take steps that you calculate are going to substantially advance your interest and you're willing to put up with criticism from overseas. My concern on this issue is that we're not going to actually advance American national security or domestic security interests, and we're going to incur substantial overseas costs that will lead to, as you point out, among other things, less cooperation from other governments. There are a multitude of ways in which governments can refuse to cooperate or drag their feet or be slow, because at the end of the day, other governments, not just democracies, have their own domestic politics. They have to be responsive to people in their home countries. And I think one of the interesting things about the past decade is, despite unhappiness in places like Europe over U.S. policy and a whole wide array of things, but particularly going back to the George W. Bush administration in Iraq, you had very good law enforcement cooperation. The real quest going forward, real sort of issue going forward or test is going to be, does that cooperation continue, or is it going to get frayed? And again, as you know well, to a large extent, dealing with the jihadist threat is a law enforcement problem. You need sort of lots of levels of law enforcement intelligence groups within countries and across countries to cooperate. And if that breaks down at any particular point, you could end up with a catastrophe. But I want to broaden the conversation, if I can, Ted, to the Trump administration's approach to immigration more broadly. We did a Facebook Live session on Friday, and that was in reaction to the president's announcements on a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. People can see the interview on my Facebook page. But I guess I just want to ask you to sort of put the executive order in the contents of the administration's broader approach to immigration.
I will do that. Can I make one last comment, though, finally, on the refugee order? It's important to keep in mind that these measures are a series of temporary measures, and the rationale for that is that the new administration is going to use that time, the 90 days, the 120 days, to overhaul U.S. vetting systems and make them better going forward. So I am going to be very interested, and I would encourage our listeners to pay attention to what are these magical new vetting systems that this administration is going to develop. Do they actually have new ideas about how to do vetting better on an ongoing basis? I'm very skeptical because, as I say, for 15 years, the United States has been improving and refining its vetting procedures. I don't know who they've got in the administration who thinks that in the next 90 days they're going to have a brilliant new set of ideas for overhauling this. But I'll be interested to see how that plays out.
Great point. And I would say the corollary to that is, to what extent will those ideas require congressional consent and will it be forthcoming?
But also a very good point. So more broadly on immigration, I think what we're learning is that we really have to take Donald Trump at face value, that what we heard throughout the campaign was that he believed, by and large, immigration was a threat to the United States. Generally, the narrative from presidents has been that immigration is one of America's great strengths. We benefit from the best and brightest around the world, from high achievers who come here, that the United States is a land of immigrants. Trump has a different view. He sees immigrants essentially as a threat on two dimensions. One, economically. They're coming and they're taking jobs away from Americans or otherwise challenging the livelihood of Americans. And secondly, as a security threat. So I think if you put together the totality of the orders on immigration last week, they foretell an administration that in a variety of ways is going to be turning more and more and more inward, that really does see immigration as weakening rather than strengthening the United States. And that is a pretty dramatic change of direction. You've got to go back to the 1920s to find political leaders in Washington who had that view and were able to pass measures and legislation to enact that view of the world. So this is a big, big change.
Let me draw you out, Nat. I mean, you put the spotlight on the question of how Americans think about themselves. And you're quite right. Traditionally, presidents get up and talk about immigration as strengthening America, being a source of why we are a city on the hill for so many other people. President Trump views it very differently. But I'm also curious about this from the viewpoint of American competitiveness in a global economy. You've written a lot on that topic as well. You have a brand new book out called Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. And obviously, one of the big challenges is having a workforce that is matched to sort of the needs of the U.S. economy. With the executive order we saw on Friday and other steps the administration has taken on immigration, we've seen a large number of companies, corporate leaders, coming out and saying this is not a good idea. Some of it has come from organizations in Silicon Valley, but I saw today that the head of Goldman Sachs also, I think, sent a message to all of his employees about how diversity is a strength and we need not to lose sight of that. How does this play into your sense of America's future economic competitiveness?
Well, I mean, certainly, if you listen to what the companies have been saying and keep in mind, these are some of the most successful companies in the world. And they
and we're talking Microsoft, yeah, Google, Amazon,
you know, Facebook, Amazon, Intel, you know, Boeing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They see their access to a global talent pool, a lot of it funneled through American universities, which remain the best in the world, as a key component of their competitiveness. And they argue, look, you know, these people come in, they do work that creates more work for us, that helps employ more Americans. You've got a win-win kind of situation. But there is another side to this, which the Trump folks have really keyed into, which is somewhat darker, right? You know, you can tell the Intel or Facebook story where they get, you know, the best programmers from around the world and that's why they're world-beating companies. But you've also got under the H-1B program what are often referred to as the Indian outsourcing companies who are bringing in lower-skilled programmers, lower-paid programmers, and in some cases displacing Americans. There was the big story that the New York Times broke last summer about employees at Disney who were forced to train their Indian replacements on back-office work. And so, you know, there is a not insignificant set of criticisms about how these programs have been handled. You know, this administration is not just worried, as previous administrations were, about illegal immigration or about the vulnerabilities to terrorists entering the United States. They are very skeptical about legal immigration. They think in a lot of cases, people coming in through the H-1B program or our other high-skilled visa programs are taking jobs away from Americans. I think if you look at it from a broader competitiveness perspective, this is going to be a bad thing for the United States. It's going to drive a lot of talented foreigners to other places. But that's not who the Trump folks are listening to. They are listening to the Americans who believe they've lost their jobs as a result of immigrant competitors. So again, a very, very different approach. I think in the long run, it will be a damaging one. I think it will make the United States more insular. I think it will really hurt the competitive advantages that we have had as the world's biggest magnet for talent. And that's why the companies are speaking out, because they see the danger in this regard.
But I take your core point, Ted, to be that there are changes that can be and perhaps should be made to American immigration policy as it relates to the broader economy. But overall, having talented people from other parts of the world come here to study and start companies is something we can't lose sight of.
Absolutely. I mean, with all these things, right, there's a proper balance. And you can argue that, you know, on both trade and immigration, maybe we tilted a little too much to the openness side and that had some detrimental impacts on some Americans. But now you have this administration which is slamming the pendulum in the other direction. And I think the costs of doing that for the U.S. economy are going to be extremely high.
Okay, I guess that leaves us with that old cliche, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Indeed.
We will end on that note for this episode of The President's Inbox. Ted, thanks for joining me today.
Good to be with you, Jim. Thank you.
Please be sure to subscribe to The President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed in The President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo with senior producer Jeremy Sherlich and recording engineer Dan Mudd. Special thanks also to Audrey Bowler. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on The President's Inbox.